Legoland Podcast with David Amoyal.
Benvenuti, as we would say in Italy. Welcome to all of you that don't speak Italian. Thank you so much for joining us for the second episode of the week of the Calcio Land Podcast. And this episode is brought to you by our great friends at Euro Fantasy Game. I hope all you guys have been playing the Champions League fantasy game that they have, which is fantastic when there is that competition. They also have leagues for all the various European leagues, from the Dutch League to Serie A, Premier League, La Liga. They cover it all, as well as a lot of great articles on Serie A. I have one on Marotta coming on there shortly. So today, we are finally going to take a deep dive on Juve. We just recorded an awesome interview with our great friend Adam Digby. We covered a lot of topics on Juve. That's towards the end. That'll be a big chunk of the podcast. We're going to get to the game picks from our friend Thousand Names and answer some of your Twitter questions. But before we get to all that, I am joined by our co-host, producer, Alex Goldberg, who is killing it now on his YouTube channel. So, Alex, I figured we'd start with the Champions League. Great week for Serie A teams. They won all four matches and the coefficient. They passed England this week. Really, things couldn't have gone better for Serie A clubs in the Champions League this week. So because you follow other leagues much more than I feel like you can answer this question a lot better. So I'm just going to ask you, are there any teams in the Champions League that you think are definitely better than Juve at this point?
All right, Dave, it's a great question. But in my opinion, there's only one team that is clearly better than Juve in the Champions League. I'll go league by league, explain my reasoning real quick. In Ligue 1, you only have PSG as an option, but PSG is not better than Juve. On paper, they're an absolute monster, but they are not a team. They are not a team yet. Maybe Gigi Buffon will rub off some of his team and leadership qualities. However, right now, PSG is only a collection of parts. They will only go as far as Kylian Mbappe and Neymar's performances go. So let's move to the Bundesliga. It could only be Bayern Munich, but they are not clearly better than Juve. They're probably about tied. Maybe Juve are even better because they have a better manager. Bayern are very deep. They almost always have almost as good of a B squad as an A squad, but they are not clearly better than Juve. In fact, this week they started Ian Robin and Frank Ribery on the wings. And yes, I know they're just rotating players in and out, but that's not great. Robin is 34, Ribery's 35. They might lack some of that firepower if Thomas Müller and Lewandowski are not in great form. So Bayern, no. Let's move to Serie A. Well, we know in Serie A, Juve are the best, so nobody in Serie A in the Champions League is better than Juve. Let's move to La Liga. You have Barcelona, who is a giant, obviously, but in my opinion, they're a little bit closer to PSG right now. They even have more of a plethora of options in the attack than PSG does, but they're very imbalanced in my opinion. I think they're better than PSG overall, but they're not nearly as good in the defense or the midfield as they are in the attack. They could still clearly win the Champions League, but I don't think at all that they are clearly better than Juve. I wanted to say Real Madrid because, David, they've won three straight Champions Leagues, and I'm going to steal your quote. Until the status quo changes, I'm going to believe it will remain the same. So how can I really say a bad thing about Real Madrid in the Champions League? However, I'm not going to say they're clearly better than the Juve because they lost this player. I don't know if you've ever heard of him. Oh, Cristiano Ronaldo. And he's on the team I'm comparing them against. So nowhere are they clearly better because, yes, they're a great team, Real Madrid. However, who are they going to turn to when they really need a goal deep into the Champions League? They don't have Ronaldo to do that anymore. They still have many great players who can do it. Gareth Bale's been in great form to start the year. Karim Benzema's been better to start the year. However, who are they really going to turn to when they really need a goal? I don't know. Maybe it's an Isco, maybe it's an Asensio, maybe it's Bale, but I think they're still a little bit of a hole in Ronaldo's absence on Real Madrid. So that leaves one league left. It's the Premier League. It's only one team I'm even possibly considering. I'm not considering Liverpool. They're not deep enough. If they lose a Salah, Mane, or a Firmino, they're in trouble. It's Manchester City. In my opinion, Manchester City are clearly better than Juve, at least right now, because they are so damn deep, but they are so appropriately deep, David. They have so many damn good attackers, but they fit Pep Guardiola. They're perfect for Pep Guardiola. They're not a collection of parts because this is all part of what Pep Guardiola wants to do. And by the way, they do have some pretty damn good defenders as well. Their wingbacks are really strong now. So I am definitely saying Manchester City are right now the best team in Europe. So David, that bodes well for Juve though. I only said one team is clearly better than Juventus, and that's Manchester City. So I want to get your take though on Juve specifically. What, in your opinion, David, stands out to you about this current Juve?
So I've talked about it a little bit before. For me, it's really the mentality and the fact that they are aware of their strength. I almost think maybe that match against Real Madrid when they scored three goals there and almost made an incredible comeback in that match. To me, that was really a big turning point for Juve. I think there they knew that they really had a chance to win the whole cup. Then, of course, they added Ronaldo and everything that comes with that. And I literally mean everything that comes with that. And today, Bonucci, we did an interview that he gave to Corriere di Torino. And Bonucci said, look, this is the best Juve I've been on. The mentality is just much better. We are much more ruthless and confident in ourselves. And that's really what I think is the key with Juve. We saw in the Champions League, they won their first away match, something that in the past they would have gone to just get a draw. Instead, they went, said, we're coming here to win. And they did. They played at home against the weaker teams in years past, against Young Boys. In the years past, Allegri would have had the handbrake on the whole time. They would have won 1-0. If that, and you know, not put in a convincing performance, and that's not what happened against Young Boys. So to me, the mentality has different change has definitely changed. Everything about Juve in recent years speaks about them wanting to have a much more international and European brand. It started with the logo. That's, you know, I think for a lot of people, it's grown on them. It's definitely really stands out. It helps their branding internationally. Of course, Ronaldo, and even, you know, the switch away from Marotta, and we've talked a lot about him on the podcast, and we'll talk about it even more with Adam Digby towards the end. To me, that was another move in them saying, you know, we're moving outside the Italian borders. We're thinking internationally. Marotta's a fantastic director, knows Serie A calcio as well as anyone, but they really want to improve that dimension. And I think Juve just knows it's all about the Champions League now for them. So that's really what's changed for me.
All right, so David, I guess a logical follow-up would be, now let's move away from Juve specifically. How about, does anything stand out to you in the Champions League for Italian teams in general?
Yeah, I think this was a great week. You know, Di Francesco, we talked about it last week, and I was on John Solano's podcast. He really needed to turn things around, and boy, did he do. Won the derby, won against Frosinone, once convincingly in the Champions League. So now he's back fully in control of the team. Dzeko continues to be incredible for them in the Champions League. I saw this stat from Roma Stats on Twitter, a great account, that Dzeko has now scored 11 Champions League goals in 14 matches for Roma. I saw you once in a while, and I love those, send some fantasy tips from the Calcioland account. You had one on under. You certainly hit a home run there. So Roma did really well there. Napoli, I mean, that was such an impressive win against Liverpool. I was able to watch a decent amount of that match. Liverpool really didn't have much. Alisson was probably their best player, which says it all. Ancelotti continues to be a chameleon with the lineup. Played Maximovic as a fullback, which was definitely unexpected. Insigne continues to be on fire. What a match by Alan. I mean, what more can you say? You know, we give a lot of takes on this podcast. Some are good, some not so good. Some of them are pretty good, and you and I have been on the bandwagon that Alan is right there in the conversation for best midfielder in Serie A, and he put in an absolutely magistral performance against Liverpool yesterday. So great for them. But I want to close on Inter. I have to say, I was really impressed. That win against PSV was a statement win for Inter. I fought against Spurs. They won kind of like an Italian fashion. Weren't the best team, but were really gritty, made a comeback. Against PSV, I thought they were the better team in the match. They've been really impressive, won the first two games in this group. You know, they were in the draw. They were in the fourth pot. Maybe they can do like Roma and win outright a group where a lot of us didn't expect them to do well. Nainggolan has certainly exceeded my expectations. To me, it's not surprising. Inter got off to a slow start. You and I, Alex, got a lot of criticism for being so high on Inter going into the season. But it's not really a surprise now that the newer players are getting integrated that the team's doing a lot better. Lautaro Martinez scored on Saturday in Serie A. We had Nainggolan, score yesterday, had a great game. I thought Politano was very good in that match. Asamoah has been good all season for them. So it's not surprising that as the new players get integrated, Inter's very tough. And, hey, you know, it's at the point that a couple of volcano eruptions out of the blue that maybe help Inter a little bit with the schedule. Hey, I'm not going to put any limits. They might make a very deep run. Certainly have a team with the quality to do well in Europe. So if you're a fan of Serie A and not just so focused on clubs, you have to be absolutely thrilled with what we saw in the Champions League. So now let's pivot and talk a little bit about Serie A. We have one more weekend of matches before another dreaded international break. And as usual, I had our dear friend, Thousand Names, email me picks for three games, which he gets to pick, and I'll make my picks as well. So the first game pick for Thousand Names is Juve traveling to Friuli to play against Udinese. Thousand Names has it as 1-1, goals by DePaul and Chiellini. His comment is Ronaldo's going to miss a penalty. He's obsessed with this. And he says that while Udinese is going to try to give Juve a favor and let him win, Juve isn't going to be able to take advantage of this because Ronaldo continues to be a disaster. I don't know what matches Thousand Names is seeing. And his final comment is that you can already feel Marotta's absence. In Italian, Udinese Juve 1-1, De Paul Chiellini, Ronaldo sbaglia rigore, l'Udinese prova a scansarsi, ma la Juve non ne approfitta, Portoghese ancora disastroso, si sente già l'assenza di Marotta. I'm going to disagree, I'm going to have Juve winning. Udinese got off to a pretty decent start, but they really haven't shown much at all. De Paul, who Thousand has scoring the game, has pretty much been their only bright spot. This season, I'm going to have Juve winning 2-0, and I'm going to give Mandzukic and Dybala goals. Next up from Thousand Names, Atalanta-Sampdoria. He has Atalanta winning 2-0, goals by Gomez and Barrow. Gasperini returns to victory against Giampaolo. Goalkeeper Audero is going to be a disaster. He's really no good. In Italian, Atalanta-Samp. 2-0, Gomez Barro, Gasperini torna alla vittoria contro Giampaolo, disastroso Audero, scarsissimo. Now, I will say this, Atalanta absolutely needs a win here. They've really struggled this season. They're only 1 point off the last relegation zone spot, really falling behind for a Europa League spot, which is their objective. Sampdoria, very good home team, not so much on the road. So I'm going to agree. I'm going to have Atalanta winning 1-0, and I'm going to give a goal, gol deluxe by Zapata. Final game picked by Thousand Names. This is an intriguing one. Lazio-Fiorentina. He has it as 1-1, goals by Immobile Gerson. Very disappointing performance by Inzaghi coach team, and that Milinkovic-Savic is a ghost in this match. Talked about it on the podcast. I'm starting to get a little bit worried that all the fame, all the attention maybe went to Milinkovic-Savic head. Let's see if he turns it around. In Italian, Lazio-Fiorentina 1-1. Immobile Gerson, altra prestazione deludente di Inzaghi, Milinkovic, un fantasma. Now, Lazio is playing in the Europa League today, but I think they really need a win after losing the derby. I'm going to have Lazio winning 2-1. I'm going to give a goal to Immobile Correa, and for Fiorentina, I'll give one to Simeone. So those are our game picks. We have some of our listeners. I love it. Tweet us in your game picks as well. We can see how you do. So to recap, Thousands has Juve, Udinese as a draw. I have Juve winning. Thousand and I agree Atalanta is going to beat Sampdoria. And I have Lazio beating Fiorentina. He has it as a draw. So one thing that's never a draw and always a victory for us is when our listeners send in Twitter questions. We love getting it. You guys are essentially co-writers of the podcast with me. you have a question on calcio, transfers with the international break coming, TV, music, films, journalism, fire away with the calcio land hashtag. And which ones are we going to go over today?
All right, let's start off with this topical question, David. Considering the fact that Morata and his team took Juve from 7th place to their current golden era, is letting him go an example of President Agnelli's hubris?
It's a good question. And look, those who have read me and followed me for a long time, I can't say that Andrea Agnelli is my favorite person. I certainly respect how ruthless he is in a lot of ways. So I could see why someone would think that. Now, I don't think it's a question of hubris. As I said before, I think it's just Juve having a more European dimension, Juve trying to make their management team younger. All the people that they promoted are in their mid-40s. Andrea Agnelli's in his mid-40s, Nedved, Paratici. So I can see why someone could think that, but I don't think it falls under that.
Okay, fair enough. How about this, David? Could you see Morata joining Inter?
It's interesting. We were talking about it on Monday when I explained what Marotta's role is. He's not a sporting director. He's not a scout. He's not someone who's going to discover a player and say, we need to sign him. So you'd have to find a club who already has someone that does that role, and someone, Marotta's more of an administrator, finance guy. So actually, Inter on paper isn't the worst fit for them because they have a director who picks players, and that's Ausilio, who I think does a good job. Now, sometimes those moves haven't translated to results, but in a lot of ways, the players he bought made sense. And right now, the moves Ausilio made last summer is really starting to pay off. So on paper, it makes a lot of sense that he would go to a club like that. Now, there's been some reports from some sources on this. I can't confirm these. I did some digging. So far, I can't say that that I can confirm those reports. I would imagine Marotta is going to stay in Italy. I know a lot of Premier League fans would love to have him, but my guess is he's going to stay in Italy. I won't exclude Inter quite yet, and I also won't exclude a role with the Italian Federation despite Marotta's denials.
All right. Next Twitter question. Would former Inter owner Moratti make a good president for the Italian Federation?
Yeah, so this one's actually, this has been in the news a lot, and actually it's Andrea Agnelli who's kind of sponsoring him, Moratti to be the president of the FIGC. Not the craziest move in the world. Moratti oversaw the treble at Inter, did a lot of good things, maybe was a little bit too emotional and attached to his players. I could see him being an intriguing figure there. I think, too, having a former Inter president heading the Italian Federation might actually help with all the conspiracy theories surrounding Juve. And I think the fact that Andrea Agnelli is sponsoring him really goes to show that rivalries are much more for fans and that the top clubs usually are somewhat in cahoots with one another.
All right, fair enough. How about this, David? Could Zlatan Ibrahimovic return to AC Milan?
So this is another one that kind of makes sense on paper. The MLS season ends in December. Zlatan's been doing really well there. You know, could he go to Serie A to finish the season there? David Beckham did that. It's not out of the question. We know Milan could use a striker other than Higuain and Cutrone. They are very thin. We've seen Milan bring back a lot of legends. So, yeah, I don't have any hard, concrete news on this, but it wouldn't shock me. I think it would definitely be just a temporary thing. I think Ibrahimovic sees his move to Los Angeles beyond football, something that he can even do beyond his career with the game. So, interesting. I could see it on loan, though, to finish the season at Milan. And, man, that would be great for Serie A if he returned.
That after Ronaldo going there? Yeah. Absolutely. So, David, this is a good question. I like this one. Who are the best fullbacks in Serie A?
So I talk about this all the time. That is the position on the market, not just in Serie A, that I think is the scarcest right now. It's hard to find quality fullbacks. So I'm sure I'm forgetting some. Now, there are those that you would have said in years past were in the conversation. Alexandro, we've talked a lot about him, just not the same player. Kolarov, sensational last year. He scored in the derby. Other than that, he's been better recently, not off to a great start. Verschalko's been injured. Conti on Milan's been injured. So those are out of the equation. I do have a couple that I want to bring to your attention. Two that everyone knows. Asamoah, I think, has been really good for Inter, although he's played quite a bit in the midfield. But I thought last season he was Juve's most consistent wingback. Cancelo, I've always been a big fan. What I saw of him at Inter, I think he's been really, really good at Juve. I think if he isn't already the best fullback in Serie A, he will be very soon. He can play on both sides too. Hizaj on Napoli has kind of maybe not doing as well. The Malquid, who they brought in, seems to bring more of an offensive game to the equation. So let's see how that works out. Napoli is going to get a big boost once Ghoulam comes back, although Mario Rui has been quite good this season. And two names that I'm going to give you are more under the radar. We've talked about Fiorentina's Milenkovic quite a few. Used to be a center back. He's been used as a right wing back in a 3-5-2. He's been quite good. I think he's going to be a big name on the transfer market next summer. And another one that I'm going to give you is on Spallazzari, who's played for the Italian national team in the previous international break. Definitely a player to watch. I think he's ready for a leap to a top club. I have a feeling I'm definitely forgetting a few, but those are the ones that stand out to me.
Well, you're not forgetting this player, but I just want to throw him in there. Chelsea have a youngster, Ola Aina, on Torino, who's looked pretty good.
But good shout.
Yeah, he's not bad. But David, I'm so frustrated here because I agree with you that Alexandro is certainly taking a step down. But because of that reason, I thought, okay, on FIFA this year, FIFA 19, FIFA Ultimate Team, Alexandro's price is going to be way down now. Nope, he's still an 86 rated, and he still goes for like 80,000 coins. So I wish that FIFA would actually call a spade and say that Sandro's been worse so I could afford him in FIFA Ultimate Team, but that's just me being selfish. So I'll stop spieling because that concludes our Twitter segment for this episode.
So we haven't taken a deep dive on Juve in quite some time. We circled back on Napoli on Monday with our great friend Kubani, and we kind of wanted to piggyback on the great match between Juve and Napoli from Saturday with our dear friend Adam Digby. You guys know Adam as one of the most eloquent and best Serie A calcio writers out there. You can read him on 442, BR Football, a host of different websites. And he's also the author of a fantastic book in English called Juventus, A History in Black and White, which covers the story of the old lady. So, Adam, you've been a frequent guest. It's always fantastic to welcome you to Calcio Land. How you doing today?
I'm good. Thanks for having me back on. How are you?
I'm doing fantastic. So, Adam, the game against Napoli was Saturday. It feels like almost a lifetime ago because so much is going on at Juve, both on the pitch, off the pitch, just a lot of topics. So I wanted to kind of take a deep dive with you on the club. Nobody knows them better than you. So I want to start a little bit with the pitch first, and then we'll get to all the hot topics off it. So, you know, on the podcast, we've talked a lot how Allegri's teams tend to peak later in the season, how usually at the beginning of the season, he doesn't show all of his cards. The athletic preparation is more geared towards peaking in March, but Juve's off to a gangbuster start. They've won 9 in a row. A lot of Juve fans like to also complain that maybe it's not as aesthetically pleasing as it should be. So give me your assessment of how Juve has started the season. Would you say the results are a true reflection of the performances so far?
Yeah, I think there's some truth to both sides of that, to be honest. I think that the results, you can't argue with 9 wins out of 9, can you? It's only the third time I think the club's ever done it. If they win on Saturday, it'll be a record start all time. And so you can't really argue with that. And like you say, we've seen in the past 4 years with Allegri, it's a slow start. They play with the handbrake on the whole time. And I still think that's the case in a lot of ways, to be honest. I think he allowed them to play a lot more freely against Napoli. But I think in most of the other matches, we saw on Tuesday night against Young Boys, they raced out to a 2-0 lead. And then just completely stopped trying almost. They just kept them at arm's length. And Dybala got a third goal to round out his hat-trick. But it wasn't any real effort in the second half. It's just more of a training exercise. And that's what most of the games have been like this season, to be honest. They've just really eased their way into the campaign. And yes, they've got 9 wins, but they're nowhere near hitting top gear yet. It's really business as usual. It's just that the results have come along with it, which they haven't always done in the past, I think.
Certainly agree with that. So now let's talk about this Juve as a whole more in historic terms. As you mentioned, they've only had a start this good 3 times. They're going for the record 10th win in a row. And look, obviously Ronaldo gets a lot of attention, especially these days. But beyond Ronaldo, I mean, Juve brought back Bonucci. We'll get to in a minute. They, to me, really bolstered a position of weakness with Joao Cancelo. So this, you know, I think it's clearly the best team since Calciopoli scandal. But since you've covered the team's history, how do you rate it compared to maybe the teams that Moggi, Giraudo, and Bettega put together? They did win 1 Champions League, made quite a few finals with these people leading the team. So kind of give me your assessment of how you view this group compared to those teams.
I think potentially they're on a par with the team. I think they're equal already to the Calciopoli team. I think the team is that deep, that strong. You look at that team was able to bring one of Trezeguet, Del Piero, or Zlatan off the bench, and Marco Di Vaio as well. And then you look at this team with Mandzukic, Ronaldo, Dybala, Bernardeschi, Costa, Cuadrado. The depth is certainly there that rivals any of the great teams in Juve's past. But as I said last time I was on, the real difference is 2 of the teams in Juve's past won the European Cup or the Champions League. And until this team does that, it's really just a tallest man in Lilliput type deal, isn't it? I think history, those of us who are there and watching it will be able to appreciate the greatness of this team. But I think in time, people will look back and it reflects on a poor general state of Serie A because they weren't able to translate that dominance into European success. So for me, for this team to really make its mark and stand out above all of the others, put it in the same bracket as the first incarnation of the Del Piero team with Lippi when they won the Champions League, or Michel Platini at his best, to really get into that elite tier of Juve team, they need to win in Europe. And they've certainly given themselves the window to do that, as you say, with signing like Bonucci and Cancelo. But you have to go and do it, because otherwise it's just a potential that goes unrealized, I think.
Yeah, I like that you compared it right away to the Calciopoli team. I always feel like Capello's teams, you know, there's a lot of the complaints that you hear on Allegri are similar. I mean, there wasn't Twitter back then. On Capello, so it'll be interesting to see if they get over the hump. So tell me a little.
Yeah, I think the one difference you have to say to Capello's Juve is Capello's Juve failed the first time they came up against any good side in Europe. The Arsenal team and the Liverpool team that eliminated that Juve from Europe in those 2 seasons were very poor. And under Allegri, at least, Juve have got big wins over Bayern, over Barca, Real Madrid, Tottenham. They've done much, much better in Europe than those teams. So I think really you have to say they're above them already. It's the differences between the teams that won the Cups. But yeah, you can see that comparison to Capello, certainly.
Yeah, no, I think that's very fair. So now let's talk about, I wanted to ask you, which players have stood out to you this season? Juve's had a decent amount of turnover in the summer. Some of the players from last season establishing themselves even more. But which players have stood out to you so far?
I think Cancelo, for sure. He's made some mistakes defensively, but I think he's not the only one guilty of that. I think he adds an extra dimension going forwards on the right. I think it's taken a little bit of time to try and find a balance between him and Sandro because they both like to get forward so much. And in the past, we've seen Allegri where he'll play Asamoah with Dani Alves to balance the team, to make the team almost lopsided one way. And then he'll play Batzal or Lichtsteiner at right back with Sandro at the other side to do the same. I think having 2 forward-thinking and attack-minded fullbacks at the same time he's going to take a little bit of time to eke out the problem. And I think that's probably why we've seen Cancelo get caught a little bit high up the pitch at times. I think Bonucci seems to have settled back in quite well. He made some mistakes in the first few games where he was certainly responsible for a number of the goals that Juve conceded in the first few weeks. Seemed a lot better against Young Boys on Tuesday. And he was very good before that too. Emre Can's been a nice surprise in midfield. And then I think it's the usual suspects. Mandzukic has been superb. His relationship with Ronaldo is already excellent. He's kind of like a juiced up Benzema, I guess. He does all the hard work that Benzema does. He just does it better. And he's been scoring goals as well. And one player who we kind of touched on last time, and I was quite disparaging in my comments about him, Federico Bernardeschi. He's been superb for me this season. All the criticism I had of him was all based around his immaturity and his unwillingness to put in a solid effort over the course of a single 90 minutes, let alone a 2 or 3 week period. But I think since this season started, he's come back and he looks much more focused. He's got rid of the stupid fringe that was always in his eyes that he always needed to flick out. And I think that the mindset that stems from that about being all business and looking to work hard and get the job done has translated into his play. I think he's been a much more focused player, much more driven player. And he seems like the desperate little brother trying to please Cristiano Ronaldo. And it's benefiting everybody because it really is paying dividends. His play has been fantastic for me and in a variety of positions as well.
Yeah, I definitely agree. I think Bernardeschi's probably with Mandzukic, maybe Juve's best player this season. Yeah, not only is he more mature, he's in great shape and has certainly, and the Ronaldo effect, probably more than any other player, it's rubbed off on him. So you mentioned a little bit on Bonucci, and I wanted to ask you just a little bit more about him. So, you know, obviously his passing ability was something Juve really lacked. You know, Pjanic being the only kind of playmaker in the midfield until Betancourt gets up to speed. So that's been definitely a big positive. He's had some very impressive passes. As you mentioned, his defense been a little bit shaky, especially in Serie A. I think most of the goals, if you had to put a responsible party, you'd go to him. So let me ask you if, A, you think overall he's still been a net positive, and what's your take on how he has reintegrated himself at Juventus? It seems that after, you know, a fairly difficult start, slowly but surely, it's back to business as normal for him.
Yeah, I think so. I think that's the main thing, isn't it? He's come back. He's stayed very, very quiet. He's got his head down. He's working hard to try and integrate himself back into the team, which is very easy because he's obviously been playing with Bartali and Chiellini for years for Juve, and obviously that carried on the national team even while he was at Milan. And we've seen them on holiday together, so obviously their understanding hasn't been impacted at all. I think more than anything, it's probably a case of the pressure and the hostility he's felt from the Juve fans, which is exact opposite of what he had before when he was one of the most beloved players in the team. I think that clearly affected him in the early going. I think, his passing, I think he's never been an incredible defender. I think on his day, he's capable of being very good. But I think the way that Bernardeschi performed last year, I think you could probably say that in terms of just being a defender, they're probably about even. I think Bonucci's impact is when Juve are in possession, whether it's from set pieces where he's much more deadly than Bernardeschi. And then obviously, as you mentioned, his passing. I think we had times last year where you watched Juventus, and not only is Pjanic the only playmaker in the team, really, he's the only player capable of making a pass of more than about 10 or 15 yards. And having Bonucci there to do that, as he did to great effect against Young Boys for the first goal, that just adds an extra dimension to Juve's play and means that the opposition can't just sit on top of Pjanic, because that would leave space behind where, and Bonucci's not got a problem in firing a 40 or 50 yard ball up the field with great accuracy. And that's exactly what happened with Young Boys. They were sort of pressing three quarters of the pitch, so he had all the time in the world to pick out that pass. And if teams do push up on him, then he can play a shorter pass, and then you can get out with the pace on the wings or through Pjanic. And it just stops Juve being predictable, and that has to be a positive. And I think overall, that's where I'm at with it. He's settled in quite well. He's made those mistakes, but because of his ability when Juve are in possession, he's an improvement on anybody else Juve have had in that position in the time that he was gone or since. And he makes the team just better overall. I think it's been a very wise decision from whoever's made the decision to not have him be his caps count towards being captain, because obviously, as we know with Juve, Chiellini is the captain, and then the next player with the most amount of appearances will wear the armband after him. And when Barzagli's not on the field, it's Bonucci. So I think the kind of, whether they're just saying, well, we'll only count it from the start of this season and he's that far behind everybody else. But we've seen Dybala with the armband. We saw Barzagli again with it, and Chiellini. I think even Mandzukic had it at one point. But it's probably a wise decision, because it's only going to, we know what it's going to do on Twitter. There's going to be 100 people tweeting a picture of, oh, captain, my captain, I'm so glad it's Bonucci. And 200 other people saying, oh, I can't believe that scumbag is wearing the captain's armband already. So you just completely ignore the controversy and let somebody else do it. And it saves all the hassle, doesn't it?
Yeah, I'm not surprised they've handled that way, but I'm with you. That was the right thing to do. So you've written about this topic recently, and obviously Dybala, you know, after a couple of benchings, is back to his brilliant self, had a hat trick against Young Boys, but it was a match where Ronaldo didn't play. And, you know, as you mentioned, Mandzukic is just the perfect partner for Ronaldo for a variety of reasons. But let me ask you, do you think it's a matter of time that Allegri, Dybala, and Ronaldo figure it out, that they can coexist? And do you think that is only feasible in like a 3-5-2 formation or a variation of that, where it's just the two of them up front, kind of a little bit what we saw in years past when Dybala and Mandzukic were playing together? How do you see that fit evolving, and will it ever work?
I think it's no coincidence to me that in the best performances of Dybala this season have come when he's moved into a more central role. He's a lot of things, Paulo Dybala. He's a very talented footballer, but the one thing he certainly isn't is a winger. And Juve, frankly, have better wingers than him. Whether you're playing Ronaldo out wide or not, Bernardeschi, Costa, Cuadrado even, for me, are all far better suited to that wide role. And I think Allegri's recognised that. And the past few weeks, we've seen him move away from the 4-3-3 that he tried initially. Yeah, as you say, we've seen some 3-5-2. And we saw, against Napoli, we saw 4-3-1-2 with Dybala tucked in behind Mandzukic and Ronaldo. And I think, ultimately, that's probably the best way to go for him. Quite how you get Douglas Costa to fit into that when he comes back is another story. But I think that'll probably see quite a bit of chopping and changing in terms of formation. And people complain a lot that Allegri doesn't have a style, but I think Allegri's style really is just winning and doing whatever it takes to get that win, whether that's 3-5-2 yep. or 4-3-1-2 or whatever. And we saw on Tuesday night, he started out with Bernardeschi as a trequartista, and then he decided that that wasn't working, so he pushed him back into midfield because he was getting in Dybala's way, and both of them did much better after that. So even once the game has started, he's capable of finding a solution that works. And I think, obviously, as we know, Mandzukic can't play every match, Ronaldo can't play every match, neither can Dybala, neither can Costa. So I think this is what we're going to see throughout the season, is a lot of chopping and changing. I think up until now, the only combination that hasn't worked really has been Dybala, Mandzukic and Ronaldo all together, because I think all three of them really want to be the number nine. And it takes one of them playing deeper, which would be Dybala. And he did quite well in that role. So I think you can't play all three of them as a front three, but you can certainly play one behind the other two. And I also think we'll see at some point Dybala playing as the number nine, with maybe Costa or Bernardeschi on the opposite wing and Ronaldo on the other side. And then he can swap with Dybala as he did with Mandzukic. I think it's just something that's going to take a lot of time, isn't it? It's like Your podcast is fantastic, and Zach Lowe is a great podcast host himself. If you two suddenly were on the same show together, it'd take you some time to iron out the kinks and figure out how to make it work, but I'm sure you would. And it'd take Alex some time to get used to producing it as well. So I think it's kind of the same thing, isn't it? There's a lot of new ingredients there, and somebody just has to figure out how to make them work together. And Allegri's got 4 years of proving that he knows how to do that. And he's also got 4 years of proving that he's not going to show you what the best combination is in November, because it doesn't help anybody. So he's probably got a formation that we've not even seen, or a combination of players we've not even seen yet. They'll unleash on some poor, unsuspecting Premier League manager in March in the Champions League. And then we'll go, oh, yeah, of course. Why didn't I think of that? And that's why he's the manager, and we're just guys on Twitter who talk about what he's doing.
Very well said. So now let's flip to off the pitch. There's a lot of storylines going on, and I'd like to hit on the three main ones. And let's start with Beppe Marotta. So on Saturday, Marotta himself announced that he was stepping down as the executive administrator of Juve. Pretty obviously it was a decision the club made, and he said he announced it on Saturday because he knew on Monday the name of the board members were going to come out and his name wasn't going to be on it, so he wanted to anticipate everyone there. So you've covered Juve's history in your book. If I remember correctly, you got right around the start of the Marotta era in the book. So let me ask you, if you were to write an addendum to the book and you were to kind of write the whole story of Marotta at Juve's reign, what would be the main things you'd remember or want to hit up about him in the book?
I think he's actually got a really interesting career arc during his time at Juve, because when he first came, he was at Sampdoria before he was at Juve, and he brought Fabio Paratici with him from Juve, and he brought Del Neri, the coach, with him from Juve as well. And in his first season, he made some terrible, terrible mistakes in the transfer market, in appointing Del Neri, in the way that he spoke with the press. He was completely out of his depth, really. And then we saw less than a year later, he completely transformed that. And he brought in Pirlo, he brought in Lichtsteiner, he brought in Antonio Conte. He actually sent Del Neri on the post-season tour to the US with all of the players who he didn't want anymore, and kept the better players in Turin to work with Conte. And he had a really good friendship with Del Neri, so he really threw him under the bus there. And he became a lot more ruthless and a lot more well-suited to life at Juve, if I have to be honest. He started to make much better deals. He started to uncover players who'd previously been overlooked. Somebody like Arturo Vidal got his first chance at a big club with Juve and came on leaps and bounds over that time. He actually beat Bayern Munich to signing Vidal, and that led to a real sour of the relationship between Juve and Bayern for quite some time. He went out and he still made some mistakes in those next few years. He struggled repeatedly to sign a top player, as he was constantly criticised for. He made approaches for Robin van Persie, for Sergio Aguero, and it all came to nothing. And then suddenly he landed Carlos Tevez, and that seemed to be the next step for him. And from there he went on, and he rebuilt the team constantly. He hired Allegri when everyone thought that would be a disaster, and it turned out to be... He's certainly in the top four managers Juve have ever had, probably, with Conte and with Lippi and Trapattoni head and shoulders above everybody else, and then Conte and Allegri in whichever order you want to say. It'd be hard pressed to put anyone else above them in that group, I think. And then I think he's been a major part in this summer's rebuild, which was a completely different job for him than we've seen in the past. As much as I don't want to make, he had a one eye on this joke and one eye on that joke when it comes to Marotta. He really did. He managed to balance building a team for the future with winning in the short term. And this summer, he really had to move away from that in signing Ronaldo and Bonucci and Cancelo, all players who are ready to win now. And in doing so, he had to sacrifice the future in selling off a lot of young players to pay for it and giving up Mattia Caldara to Milan. And then we come to the end, and it's a real surprise. But I think the one thing that people have to get their heads around, or two things really, is first of all, the business world doesn't base itself around football seasons. It has its own calendar and its own agenda. And Juve's annual general meeting is later this month, and that is the time to make those changes rather than in May when the football season comes to an end. So yes, Juve are putting somebody else forward to be the CEO and to run the business side. Marotta would still have his contract until the end of the season as the head of the sporting sector, but his time as a member of the board of directors has come to an end. And that's natural that happens at this time of year rather than when, as football fans, we might think it should. And the other thing is, I think it's kind of the end of an era with him, and as I wrote this week, it's the start of the Fabio Paratici era. And I think in a lot of ways, as football fans over the past couple of decades, we've been kind of spoiled because we haven't kind of seen this progression. Adriano Galliani was an incredible sporting director and an incredible business mind for AC Milan, but his time certainly passed long before he ever left the post. But his good friend Silvio Berlusconi was never going to jettison him. So he outlived his welcome. And then with Calciopoli, we saw Luciano Moggi's time come to an abrupt end, probably two or three seasons before it naturally would have done. But at some point after that, Juve would have had a really difficult decision to make with him. And we never got to see that because he was banned from the sport for life. So I think this is natural. There were sporting directors at Juve before Luciano Moggi. There were sporting directors at Milan before Galliani, and we've seen others come and go and not enjoy success. I think the guys who have long-term success, like Moggi, Galliani, Marotta, eventually they do need to be replaced. And we saw that in the past, but this generation of fans, we've certainly been denied that. And now we're getting to see it again. And it does feel jarring, and it does feel too early. But Juve probably parted ways with Antonio Conte too early. They probably parted ways with Alessandro Del Piero too early. They probably sold Roberto Baggio too early. But life goes on, and it's on to the next one, and that's always the way with Juve. It's harsh, and it kind of sounds like you're making an excuse, but that's the way it is. And the third thing I would say, just to add a last comment, is Fabio Paratici is an incredible sporting director, and he's already been linked with moves away to Manchester United and to Tottenham and to Arsenal. And if Juve are going to keep him and move on for the next 15 or 20 years with the person who's going to be best suited towards that job, I guess it was probably time to give him a bit more responsibility and a bit more power in the decision-making process. And the only way to do that is to move on Marotta. And those two, as I said, those two go back together to 2004 when Paratici became a scout at Sampdoria after his playing career ended. And he's certainly not walking away right now to follow Marotta. He knows that eventually he's going to have to be the top dog, and he must obviously then therefore believe that his time is now, and that it's time to stand on his own two feet and be the man.
Yeah, a lot of interesting points there. I'm with you. For me, the big turning point for Marotta was the Tevez signing. For me, that was really that's really when things really started to change. I think, too, age is a factor here. A lot of the other guys in Juve's management team are all in their mid to early 40s. I think Juve kind of wanted to go in that direction. Marotta, 61. So I think he's a great work. You know, to me, when you look at someone at any company, a senior administrator like that, the best way to judge him is the organization better off when he left or when he arrived. And I think clearly with Marotta, the answer is yes. So I agree with a lot of the points you said. So now let's talk about the hottest topic going on around Juventus. And I feel like this is more of a Ronaldo topic in the sense that, to me, Ronaldo is really his own brand more than Juve. Everyone by now knows about the alleged rape allegations from, a while back that have resurfaced now. So, you know, without getting too much into the merits of the allegations themselves, I wanted to ask you about the impact on the team. I'll tell you, you know, for me, what's been really interesting in following all this is, you know, Alex and I are based here in the U.S. The topic, rape and the Me Too movement is something that have been at the forefront here in the U.S. for a really long time. In Italy, on the other hand, they've been barely talking about this at all. Like, the main parts of the media in Italy only picked up the story or started talking about it after Ronaldo tweeted about this yesterday. There was a radio silence on Gazzetta dello Sport, Sky, wherever. You didn't see anything till this. So I wanted to ask you, as someone who covers the club, is also very familiar with Ronaldo's career and how he wants protections and whatnot, how do you think this is going to impact the team? Let's focus on that aspect of this.
I don't think it will. I think we've seen in the past that of all football teams probably in the world, Juve are the best place to deal with off the field issues. I think we were just talking about Carlos Tevez, a man who had countless off-field issues at every other club that he was at, but when he came to Juve, you never hear a thing. It was all dealt with in-house. It never affected the team. He was given extended leave and treated very differently to many of the other players in the squad, and that didn't cause any disharmony. The way that the club is managed, both off the field and in the playing squad, is so meticulous that everybody understood why it had to be different, why things are treated differently. And I think this will just be the same. I think we've seen other controversies. We saw Martin Cáceres crash two cars on two completely separate occasions because he was drink driving. And that never became a big topic. And obviously, I know Martin Cáceres is not anywhere near the level of fame as Ronaldo, but at some other teams that would become an issue. And with Juve, it just isn't. They just deal with it. They suspended Cáceres. They moved on. And then they sold him on. And I think that will always be the same. I think at many clubs, the level of drama and scrutiny that would come with signing Ronaldo, even without this latest these latest developments, would probably be enough to destabilise the entire club. But with Juve, you know that they're going to be able to have the professionalism of the people working behind the scenes. And I think that's why, as well, it has been so quiet in Italy, because I think everyone knows the way that Juve will handle it. And just to give everybody a glimpse behind the curtain before we started recording, David said we need to be very careful how we discuss this because we don't want to get sued by Jorge Mendes. And I think that's the way that everyone feels when they come to dealing with Juve as well. We have to be careful because they will handle it in the very best way, both on the field and off it. And I think that's always going to be the case. It's something that's a very delicate matter. It's something that none of us really know. And the partisan people on Twitter, who on social media, who can't see beyond their own club colours, have already decided whether he's guilty or not. Which is frankly ludicrous because none of us have any idea whatsoever. And it's best to just stay away from that debate completely. I think the only thing we can say with any certainty is that Juve will handle it in the same way that they always do, quietly, efficiently, and in the best way possible.
Yeah, I mean, I've said that all your answers are interesting, and this one especially, because you took it in a different angle than I expected. And even, you know, the anonymity players have in Turin, that's one thing that a lot of them really enjoy, is being able to live a normal life, and that they can in a lot of places. So interesting take on that. So let's close on this. This is another topic that's been on the forefront about Juve, is the situation with the ultras. So now, full disclosure, I actually met Adam in person a few times in Turin, and it was around, you know, some common friends that we have. Some of them our ultras and all. I know Adam knows that world, you know, very well, especially with Juve. So explain to our listeners a little bit what is going on with this. So to give a little bit of background, you know, the prices at Juve Stadium have gone up substantially, even right before the Ronaldo signing. Then at least they delivered on the Ronaldo signing. There's expenses across the board, even when Juve fans travel. It's very expensive because of the Ronaldo effect. So tell our listeners a little bit, what do you think the factors are? How much of an impact do you think it actually has, the ultras, you know, being on strike on the team and the atmosphere and all? So since you're so intimately familiar with this, like firsthand going into the stadium a lot, how do you kind of see all this?
I think it's one of those topics where it's really difficult. People want to draw a line and say that ultras are bad and that the club is right. They need to be stamped out and they have too much power. And other people will say that the fans are the lifeblood of the club and they deserve to be treated with more respect and the club are just being greedy. And sadly, as always, and in most discussions you and I seem to have, David, the truth lies in the huge middle ground that neither side of the argument really wants to explore. I think that the club has made an almost ridiculous rise in ticket prices. That since the stadium opened, the cost of a season ticket in the Curva Sud, where the ultras are, has gone up by more than double. It was €275 for the season in that first year in 2011-12, and it's now over €600 for the same ticket. And the usual, the standard sort of living wage of those people in that area has not gone up by anywhere near that amount, certainly. And a lot of them, as anyone who hates Juve will tell you, that a lot of them don't live in Turin. Probably 50% of the fans in the Curva Sud come from elsewhere, which then you add on the cost of getting to Juve from Milan or wherever you happen to live, it certainly pushes that beyond a reasonable amount for those people who want to sit there. But then on the flip side, you have the club where Andrea Agnelli was taken to court because he'd been giving control of some season tickets to a group of ultras who were responsible for a lot of the choreography and are responsible for a lot of the chanting that go on in the stadium that gives that great atmosphere. So it was kind of a reward for that. And then it was discovered that those tickets were being sold by a mafia group in Calabria, and the proceeds that were made from selling those tickets was going towards funding their illegal activities. And the club are absolutely right to eradicate that. You can't be... You certainly, as a modern day business, you can't be seen to be funding illegal activity, and Juve certainly want no part of that, and that's absolutely the right decision. Those tickets should be controlled the same way that everyone else's tickets are. You need to go to the gate with your passport, it has your name on the ticket, you get in, fine. There was a long-standing practice of, there was a turnstile towards the Curva Sud where 15-20 minutes before kickoff, the attendant there who was supposed to be checking IDs would just walk away, and people would just file in with whatever ticket they had. Obviously, they still needed to scan the ticket to get in the barrier, so it was never a case of over. It was definitely turning a blind eye to it and letting these people get away with whatever they wanted, and they've moved to eradicate that. But then you come back to the fact that you talk about ultras and you talk about the Curva Sud. It's very important to draw a distinction between the fact that the entire Curva, which is about 7,000 fans, probably only around 25-30% of that are actually ultras. The rest are just fans who want to be in the Curva Sud. Let's not say sit, because nobody sits in there. And they want to go and they want to sing and they want to back the team. Because the songs, and the ultras lead the songs. And as a protest against the rising ticket prices and the loss of those free tickets and the fact that the club's really stamped down hard on people who should be banned from matches, which has led to an increase in DASPOs, which is the banning order from all stadiums in Italy. A lot more Juve fans have recently been given those because the clubs have been a lot more helpful towards the police and the authorities in handing them out. And the fans are unhappy at that. And I think both sides in the argument have a case. And both sides have to do what's best for them. And I agree with the Curva Sud in general and the ultras about the fact that the prices have gone too high. I agree with them that they are... Look, I'm a Juve fan. I go to matches. You're a Juve fan. And I think unless you're a member, a person who is a season ticket holder in the Curva Sud, I think you have to look at what they bring to the stadium and the atmosphere that they generate. And you have to say... You have to be honest enough with yourself and say that they are more important than you. And I have no problem in doing that. I think those fans are the lifeblood and the soul of Juventus. And without them singing and backing the team, the rest of the stadium is just an empty box. It's people sat at the theatre watching some form of entertainment, but it's certainly not the football that I know and love. And you watch those guys and the way that they cheer the team and the way that they talk about the team when they're not at matches, as you say, we've been among them and enjoyed their company very much. They really are the heart of this Juve. And the same with any club, you know, it's not just restricted to Juve, but there's, excuse me, there's great Curva and great Ultras groups for every team. But when we're talking just about Juve, that the Curva Sud is that. And it is really important that those guys are a part of the success going forward, because they've certainly played their part in it in the past. And there has to be a compromise that can be reached on pricing, on the tickets, on everything. And I don't think that the club should go back to doling out free tickets and letting anyone who wants to come in the Curva Sud go in the Curva Sud. It should be policed properly. But there has to be a concession that what those fans bring to the table and that what they've turned the stadium into has to be recognised. And I've got a column coming out in The Independent today or tomorrow on this subject at great length. Good. And I interviewed one of the head ultras who's actually suffering a banning order himself at the moment. And he says, we follow Juve home and away, whether they have Cristiano Ronaldo or not. And the club's reward to us is to double the ticket prices. And that's not sustainable. You're gonna squeeze out those fans. You're going to end up with a soulless stadium with no atmosphere, that's no fun to play in for the players, that's no fun for the travelling fans to come and watch. Because when you go to Juventus Stadium, you've been there, David, you've sat in a section different to the Curva Sud, and they're part of the entertainment, aren't they? They're part of what makes football great. And I've said this elsewhere, but I'll continue to say it. I think people who don't go to stadiums, it's all too easy to say, oh, well, they shouldn't do that, this is that. But really, they're talking from a studio in London or in New York or wherever, and they're commentating on a television programme. But football is living, it's breathing, it's the atmosphere, it's the smell of flare smoke in your nostrils, it's your ringing ears when the full-time whistle has blown because people have been screaming for hours. It's that noise, it's the passion, it's walking out in the car park after the game and our good friend Luca Carpi grabbing you by the collar and shaking me because he can't believe what a performance he's just witnessed. That's what football is about. And those are the people who are going to get pushed out if clubs carry on doing what they're doing to these kind of fans. And it's nonsensical to me. You people say you're cutting off your nose to spite your face, but really, Juve at the moment are cutting their own heart out, and it's really sad to see.
Yeah, I think you said it best. There's just so many. It's such a topic that so many nuance, so many angles to it. You know, there's economic factors on both sides. So very, very well said. I look forward to reading the article. I have a feeling I know what fan you interviewed. That should be fascinating. So, Adam, I can't thank you enough. You've more than helped us make up for the fact we didn't take a deep dive on Juve in a while. I feel we covered everything. So I can't thank you for coming on the podcast enough. If you've enjoyed hearing Adam on Calcioland, check out his articles, read his book. All brilliant. And Adam, thanks again for joining us. As always, it was a big pleasure for me.
No problem. Thanks for having me on, guys.